This podcast is supported by USA for UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency. UNHCR responds to humanitarian emergencies around the world that have caused record levels of displacement and human suffering. 90% of refugees live in countries facing food shortages and malnutrition. Your support is crucial in delivering vital aid to the world's most vulnerable families. Will you help support refugees by making a gift today? Together, we can help refugees and displaced people all around the world. Donate today at unrefugees.org/donation.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, the United States says its mission in Syria is to defeat ISIS and stay out of the civil war. But as it turns out, it can't do both. And where did Mitch McConnell go wrong on the Senate's health care bill? It's Thursday, June 29th. Helene Cooper, the last time you and I spoke about Syria, it was after, just after, the U.S. dropped missiles there on the Syrian military. Remind us what happened.
Well, there had been a chemical weapons attack on Syrian civilians by the regime of Bashar al-Assad.
Hospital is now being overwhelmed with patients that have been hit by some sort of chemical.
That President Trump said that he reacted strongly to it because he saw images of dead and hurt children.
Mm-hmm. Including women, small children, and even beautiful little babies. Their deaths was an affront to humanity. These heinous actions by the Assad regime cannot be tolerated.
And after that, the Trump administration took a very short period of time, something like 63 hours, to make a decision that the United States was going to retaliate. And we launched a whole bunch of TLAMs, Tomahawk cruise missiles, at the same airbase that the Pentagon had determined that the Syrian regime had launched the chemical weapons attack. And that's when we talked. I think that was three months ago.
Basically that night. And during that interview, I asked you this question. Are we now at war with Syria?
I don't know the answer to whether we are at war. We're certainly, you know, many people will say that, and especially if you get civilian casualties. Technically, we're not. There's no declaration of war with Syria, but that's a fine, that's a pretty fine point. And that's something that, you know, many smarter people than me will debate forever.
So, Helene, it's been almost 3 months since then. What's your answer to that same question now?
Are we at war with Syria?
Right.
It's still such a good question. And, you know, when I first started at the New York Times, this was a long time ago, more than like 15 years ago, Andy Rosenthal was my boss. And he told me, when you're going to cover Washington, he said, write what they do, not what they say. Mm. If you ask the United States, they will tell you immediately, the Pentagon, the White House, that we are not at war with the Syrian regime. We are in Syria fighting the Islamic State. However, what we have been doing lately sort of belies that.
So what is it that the U.S. is actually doing in Syria that may in some way belie the claim that we're not at war with Syria?
The United States in the past month or so has shot down two Syrian warplanes that American military officials say got too close to American-backed troops. We have shot down two Iranian-made drones that, the same thing, American military officials say got very close to American-backed troops. The Russians, who were backing the Syrian regime, have in retaliation buzzed in very dramatic Top Gun style an American spy plane.
And what does it mean? What does it mean to buzz?
It's like, you remember in Top Gun when these when the
You're
MiGs
dating
came
me,
really
close?
I'm dating myself.
Let's see if we can have a little fun with them.
Is this
do you have fun, man?
You know, they're making a new Top Gun, by the way. They're making Top Gun 2. But the Russian fighter jets come really close. Within 5 feet was the case of this incident last week.
Wow.
They just go really fast and very close, dangerously close.
Right.
Any Air Force person will tell you that's not safe. And it's sort of a threat. It's a we're here, we're watching you type of thing. And then you saw President Trump in the White House earlier this week come out with their threat, saying that they've now seen more evidence that the Syrian regime is preparing another chemical attack at the same air base from which they launched the one earlier this year, and that if they do it, the United States will retaliate. So it's certainly been a lot of flexing of muscle and, you know, and some actual incidents that we've had between the United States and the Syrian regime.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that the U.S., while not at war with Syria, is getting more deeply involved in a warlike way. Is that right?
Yes. The United States has viewed Syria as an adversary for a long time. But that said, when President Obama announced that he was beginning airstrikes in Syria, he said explicitly that we were not going in there to go after the Syrian regime. We believed in regime change, but we weren't going to try to execute it.
Our objective is clear. We will degrade and ultimately destroy ISIL through a comprehensive and sustained counterterrorism strategy.
We were there simply to fight the Islamic State, which was also fighting the regime of President Assad.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of in a weird way, we're on the same side as the Syrian regime. But in the last few months, as the Islamic State, which has been fighting both the United States, has been under attack from both the United States and its coalition partners, as well as the Syrian regime, as well as the Russians who back the Syrian regime, mm-hmm. as well as the Iranians who also back the Syrian regime. And the Islamic State has been on sort of come under the back foot now under all these different adversaries and all of these airstrikes. And it's now shrinking in Syria. The amount of territory that they hold is shrinking. But that also means that the battlefield has become smaller. And in the past, when Russia entered this, and, you know, with Iran and Russia both backing the Syrian regime, the United States was able to stay out of these people's way, you know, because it was a big country. Now, as that battle space has shrunk, you've seen U.S. warplanes getting closer to Syrian regime warplanes and Iranian-made drones and Russian warplanes. And it's like it's a much smaller space, and there's a lot more ability there to get in each other's way. Added to that is the fact that there's a great powers game that's going on about what happens to Syria after the Islamic State is gone. And everybody's positioning themselves now to be in a better position of power diplomatically. So all of that feeds into this very, what was already a very adversarial playing field.
So by successfully, in some ways, starting to defeat ISIS in Syria, the United States' presence there is becoming more focused and, I guess, more adversarial with Assad. It's like as if when one mission ends, another one may even kind of accidentally begin.
Wow, I would get in so much trouble if I said that, because the Pentagon would start screaming at me and saying, you know, absolutely, we're not there to fight the Syrian regime. But yeah, that is in a sort of way what's happening, because if ISIS gets thrown out of Syria, if they are defeated, you still have a country that has all of these different factions jockeying for power. Who's going to take over the ISIS-controlled territory?
Mm-hmm.
And you have the United States backing the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, who are fighting ISIS, but they're also fighting the government of President Assad. So it becomes a really intricate and difficult thing to maneuver, and it's really hard to keep to the policy that the Americans have set out, which is that we're going to help the SDF, we're going to help them fight ISIS, but we're not going to help them fight Assad. But Assad is fighting the SDF. And so are you going to help them defend themselves?
So does the United States have troops in Syria right now?
Yes. We have had special forces on the ground in Syria for several years now, and that number has increased. It goes up and it goes down, but we definitely have. I would say probably, I can't give you the exact number, but it's definitely probably in the low hundreds.
So if ISIS is on its way to being defeated and is defeated, why doesn't the United States just get out of Syria?
I mean, I think that's supposedly what the American policy is. But at that point, you've got a lot of skin in the game and you've done a lot to affect the outcome and you have your allies still on the ground. So what are we going to do? Are we going to support the Syrian Democratic Forces who we've trained and we've backed and we've given weapons to fight ISIS? And then let's say the government of President Assad then turns on them and starts spraying them with chemical weapons or attacking them. And are we just going to turn around now and say, we're not going to help you?
That's complicated.
It is. It's very complicated. And I think President Obama deserves a lot of criticism for his Syria policy because I think that was a little muddled as well. But this is all part of the reason why he dragged his feet about getting more deeply involved in Syria. As complicating and as messy as Iraq was when we went in 2003, Syria is 50,000 times more so.
So the former Cold War student in me wants to understand if one of the reasons we have to remain in Syria involved is because of the presence and the stature of Russia in Syria.
The Russian thing complicates everything even more. When Vladimir Putin decided that he was going to send Russian planes in there to back the government of Assad, it made things much worse for the United States, even though Russia ostensibly is there to fight ISIS as well. But Russia is also backing the government that's fighting these American-backed people who are fighting both the government and ISIS. So it just makes things a lot more difficult and why the only real way to see a solution is if all of these parties come to the diplomatic table and sit down and carve up the country in some sort of way. And that's similar to what happened after World War II with in Europe.
Helene, you're in the Pentagon all the time. You talk to military advisors. Is there an anxiety, to bring it back to our original question from 3 months ago, that even if we're not at war, we may be quietly and maybe even accidentally sliding into war with Syria?
If you talk to them privately, they will acknowledge the inherent contradictions of American policy. They say that the military gains have outstripped the political diplomacy. You know, so we've gone faster on the military angle in defeating ISIS than the politics has caught up with us. What do you do with the country after you've run ISIS out of town? And they acknowledge that now we're getting into a very tricky space. But they also will say, you know, our job as military officials is to carry out the policy of our civilian leaders. So there you have it. You know, it's one of those things where you do think it's crying for a diplomatic solution and one quickly, because we're getting at the point where things have changed and the facts on the ground have completely changed.
Helene, thank you very much.
Thanks, Michael.
We'll be right back.
With Schwab Investing Themes, it's easy to invest in ideas you believe in, like online music and videos, artificial intelligence, electric vehicles, and more. Schwab's research process uncovers emerging trends. Then their technology curates relevant stocks into themes. Choose from over 40 themes. Buy all the stocks in a theme as is or customize to better fit your investing goals, all in a few clicks. Schwab Investing Themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Learn more at schwab.com/thematic investing.
Hey, y'all. It's Kyra Blackwell from Wirecutter, the product recommendation service from the New York Times. And I test mattresses. Today, I am testing 7 mattresses, all brand concealed. It just feels like such a daunting endeavor to pick the right mattress. This mattress is very supportive. It's just like very easy to shift positions. We've considered nearly 4 dozen foam, inner spring, and hybrid mattresses. We're looking out for edge support, motion isolation, and firmness levels. We are cross-referencing our data between testers, which includes people of all different shapes, sizes, and sleep preferences. When it came right out the box, it smelled like lavender. I'm not sure how long it'll last. I finished compiling all of my tester surveys. One tester noted the mattress had some give and underlying firmness and support. At Wirecutter, we do the work so you don't have to. For independent product reviews and recommendations for the real world, come visit us at nytimes.com/wirecutter. It feels very squishy, but in a good way.
Michael.
Jennifer.
We meet again in a phone booth.
It's been so long.
I know. Have you been longing for me to unpack community rating for you?
So, Jennifer Steinhauer, what was Mitch McConnell's mistake in this healthcare bill?
Well, not to be flip about it, but in a sense, his mistake was doing it at all, right? Mitch McConnell told Republicans very early on in this Congress that they had to make good on their promise to voters that they've been making for the better part of the decade to repeal the health care law. And it seemed that Leader McConnell believed that at the end of the day, no Republican was going to want to stand there and be the one or the ones to stand in the way of repealing Obamacare. Well, guess what? As it turned out, he hadn't taken into account the fact that American politicians are not successful almost ever at one thing, and that's rolling back entitlements. And he woke up realizing that many Republican senators came from states that had expanded the Medicaid program under the health care law, and their governors, including a lot of Republicans, liked it that way. And that was a real difficulty for him to make them reconcile this promise to voters and then to get down to the brass tacks of actually doing it. And so what he kind of did was picked a side, if you will, with conservatives who wanted to make the law a little, you know, more conservative, a little more onerous for Medicaid recipients. And that just so far has not worked.
Okay, but that strategy did work in the United States House of Representatives. So why did that strategy compel Republicans in the House but not in the Senate?
Okay, so first of all, there's the difference between being a House member and a senator, where senators have to represent the entire state, and they're much more beholden to the entire population and the governors rather than their own district, which in many of the cases of Republicans is a pretty gerrymandered Republican district. That's the first thing. The second thing is all the cajoling and the leaning and the browbeating that President Trump and his team did in the final days before that bill got passed. That kind of strategy, that kind of pressure doesn't really work as well on senators, and it especially didn't work after they saw the president who stood in the Rose Garden celebrating that bill in a very bizarre fashion since it had not yet come to his desk, turn around and tell United States senators that, in fact, oh, forget it, that House bill was too mean, make yours nicer. What they learned from that process is the president is not a reliable partner. He's not steeped in the policy. He wouldn't have their backs, and he wouldn't necessarily be able to harm them if they opposed him. They are much more aligned with their governors than they are with the president or Mitch McConnell at this point.
So you're saying senators are just, you know, inherently less cajolable, if that's the word, than House members?
Certainly they are, especially in public policy areas that would have broad impact on their state.
So, Jennifer, with that in mind, as all these Republican senators go home for the July 4th holiday and they start interacting with constituents who've been watching a lot of cable news and have learned about the contents of this bill and the predictions of how many people it would leave without health care, are they going to be even less cajolable when they return to Washington? Is Mitch McConnell going to have an even harder time convincing them to vote for this bill next week?
So I tend to think that constituents are going to be where they started. If they really want the healthcare law repealed, they'll say so. And if they don't, they'll say that. And sometimes they're very confused about what's in the bill. And frankly, sometimes people don't even realize that they have their insurance through Obamacare. So it kind of depends on how much information voters have and where they started from. Now, this is not to say that the Affordable Care Act is some perfect piece of legislation that's bringing joy and starlight to everyone's lives, and only Republicans in the United States Congress are opposed to it. You know, there's a lot of flaws in the law. Democrats would readily admit that, too, and have often said they would like to work with Republicans to fix it, which, by the way, could be the eventual outcome. The question is this going to be the fix for it? Is this going to be a partisan bill that ultimately rolls back entitlements for millions of Americans? Is that going to be the path? Right now, it doesn't look that way. But hey, Mitch McConnell's gotten a lot of bills over the line.
Hmm. So finally, it sounds like you're saying the eventual outcome might be Democrats and Republicans working together now that Republicans are having so much trouble coalescing to fix Obamacare. That seems incredibly hard to fathom given the state of things in Washington.
It does. But, you know, the Republicans right now, Michael, really want to continue on the path with a partisan solution done through a method that would only require Republican votes and get a bill that essentially repeals the Affordable Care Act and replaces it with something far less expansive. That remains their goal. They are struggling this week desperately to get more members to say they will support the bill through various means, to reprice the bill with the Congressional Budget Office, and to really try to find a way, like Paul Ryan, you know, through a Hail Mary pass, get this thing over the line. But if that process fails, and given the state of the Affordable Care Act right now, which is teetering in many locations, they will probably be forced to reach out to Democrats who have and call their bluff, because they've said they want to work with them, and try to find a way to patch the problems in our health care system, which at the end of the day is what many people think should happen, that Republicans and Democrats should work together on such a broad and difficult policy issue.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
We'll talk soon. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Here's what else you need to know today. On Tuesday, President Trump's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, finally confirmed that his consulting firm received more than $17 million from a Ukrainian political party with links to the Russian government. Manafort was legally required to disclose that he was working on behalf of a foreign power, but didn't at the time. Last summer, he was forced out of his role with the Trump campaign because of criticism over business dealings with pro-Russian interests. And...
Hello, this is Michael Reed, and... I'm a firm believer that part of salvation is that we not only have faith in Jesus Christ, but we obey the commands of God, and that we confess Jesus as Lord. But one thing I do not support is the violation of our constitutional right to have the freedom that's guaranteed us, that guarantees us separation of church and state, because no one religion should the government represent.
After years of preparation and much controversy, a massive granite monument of the Ten Commandments was finally installed on the grounds of the Arkansas State Capitol in Little Rock this week.
Oh my goodness.
On Tuesday morning.
Freedom!
Less than 24 hours later, Michael Reed deliberately slammed his car into the monument, smashing it into pieces. Reed was charged with destroying a similar monument in Oklahoma in 2014. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/NYT. netsuite.com/NYT.